I'm so sorry. So sorry.
The women have decided that you must not see Maria for 2 months. She's very ill. You almost killed her, and she must take 2 months to recover. In this time, you will work every day. You will work long hours and hard. You will save your money. You will not drink even one drop of daru or beer or anything but water. Do you understand? No chai or milk or anything but water. You must observe this fast as part of your punishment. Joseph wagged his head feebly.
Yes, yes, I will.
Maria may decide not to take you back. You must know this also. She may want to divorce you, even after the 2 months, and if she does, I will help her in this. But at the end of 2 months, if she wants to accept you again, you will use the money you have saved by this extra hard work, and you will take her on a holiday to the cool mountains. During retreat in that place with your wife, you will face this ugliness in yourself, and you will try to overcome it. Inshallah, you will make a happy and virtuous future for your wife and yourself. This is the decision. Go now. No more talking. Eat now and sleep. Kasim stood, turned, and walked away. Joseph's friends helped him to his feet and half carried him to his hut. The hut had been cleaned, and all of Maria's clothes and personal articles had been removed. Joseph was given rice and dal. He ate a little of it, and then lay back on his thin mattress. Two friends sat near him and fanned his unconscious body with green paper fans. A cord was tied around one end of the bloody stick, and Johnny Cigar suspended it from a post outside Joseph's hut for all to see. It would remain there for the 2 months of Joseph's further punishment. Someone turned a radio on in a hut not far away, and a Hindi love song wailed through the lanes and gullies of the busy slum. A child was crying somewhere. Chickens scratched and pecked at the place where Joseph's circle of torment had been. Somewhere else, a woman was laughing. Children played. The bangle seller sang out his enticement call in Marathi. A bangle is beauty, and beauty is a bangle. As the pulse and push of normal life returned to the slum, I walked back to my hut through the winding lanes. Fishermen and fisherwomen were coming home from Sassoon Dock, bringing baskets of sea smell with them. In one of those balancing contrasts of slum life, it was also the hour chosen by the incense sellers to move through the lanes, burning their samples of sandalwood, jasmine, rose, and patchouli. I thought about what I'd seen that day, what the people did for themselves in their tiny city of 25,000 souls, without policemen, judges, courts, and prisons. I thought about something Kasim Ali had said weeks before, when the two boys, Farooq and Raghuram, had presented themselves for punishment, having spent a day tied together in work at the latrine. After they'd scrubbed themselves clean with a hot bucket bath and dressed in new lungis and clean white singlets, the two boys stood before an assembly of their families, friends and neighbours. Lamplights fluttered in the breeze, passing the golden gleam from eye to eye as shadows chased one another across the reed-mat walls of the huts. Kasim Ali pronounced the punishment that had been decided upon by a council of Hindu and Muslim friends and neighbours. Their punishment, for fighting about religion, was that each had to learn one complete prayer from the religious observances of the other.
"In this way is justice done," Kasim Ali said that night, his bark-coloured eyes softening on the two young men. "Because justice is a judgment that is both fair and forgiving. Justice is not done until everyone is satisfied, even those who offend us and must be punished by us. You can see by what we have done with these two boys, that justice is not only the way we punish those who do wrong, it is also the way we try to save them.
I knew those words by heart. I'd written them down in my work journal, not long after Kasim Ali had spoken them. And when I returned to my hut on that day of Maria's agonies, that day of Joseph's shame, I lit a lamp and opened the black journal and stared at the words on the page. Somewhere close to me, sisters and friends comforted Maria and fanned her bruised and beaten body. In Joseph's hut, Prabhakar and Johnny Cigar took the first shift to watch over their neighbour as he slept. It was hot then, as evening's long shadows became the night. I breathed a stillness of air, dusty and fragrant with scents from cooking fires. And it was quiet in those dark, thinking moments. Quiet enough to hear sweat droplets from my sorrowed face fall upon the page, one after another, each wet circle weeping outward into the words, fair, forgiving, punish, and save. Chapter 12. 1 week became 3 weeks, and 1 month became 5. From time to time, as I worked the streets of Kolaba with my tourist clients, I ran into Didier, or Vikram, or some of the others from Leopold's. Sometimes I saw Carla, but I never spoke to her. I didn't want to meet her eyes while I was poor and living in the slum. Poverty and pride are devoted blood brothers until one, always and inevitably, kills the other. I didn't see Abdullah at all during that 5th month, but a succession of strange and occasionally bizarre messengers came to the slum with news of him. I was sitting alone at the table in my hut one morning, writing, when the ghetto dogs roused me from my work with a fury of barking more frenzied than anything I'd ever heard. There was rage and terror in it. I put down my pen, but didn't open my door or even move from my chair. The dogs were often vicious at night, but that was the first time I'd ever heard such ferocity in the daylight hours. The sound was fascinating and alarming. As I perceived that the pack was coming nearer and slowly nearer to my hut, my heart began to thump. Shafts of golden morning stabbed through rents and gaps in the fragile reed walls of my hut. Those moat-filled rays stuttered and strobed as people rushed past in the lane outside. Shouts and screams joined the howling. I looked around me. The only weapon of any kind in my small house was a thick bamboo stick. I picked it up. The riot of barking and voices concentrated outside my hut and seemed to be centered on my door. I pulled open the thin piece of plywood I used as a door and dropped the stick at once. There, half a meter away, was a huge brown bear. The animal towered over me, filling the doorway with awesome muscled fur. It stood easily on its hind legs, with its enormous paws raised to the height of my shoulders. The presence of the beast provoked the ghetto dogs to madness. Not daring to come within reach, they turned on one another in their fierce rage. Ignoring them and the excited crowd of people, the bear stooped and leaned in toward the doorway to stare into my eyes. Its eyes were large, sentient, and topaz-colored. It growled. Far from threatening, the bear's growl was a rumbling, tumbling, oddly soothing roll of sound, more eloquent than the prayer that muttered through my mind. My fear slipped away as I listened to it. Across that half meter of air, I felt the reverberations of the feral noise throb against my chest. It leaned closer until its face and mine were centimeters apart. Froth dissolved to liquid and dripped from its wet black jaws. The bear meant me no harm. Somehow, I was sure of it. The eyes of the beast were speaking of something else. It was seconds only, but in that thudding stillness, the communication of an animal's sadness, undiluted by reason and complete in its passion, was so intense and pure from eye to eye that it seemed much longer, and I wanted it to go on. The dogs slashed at one another, whining and howling in agony of hate and fear, wanting to rip at the bear, but more afraid than enraged. Children screamed and people scrambled to avoid the thrashing dogs. The bear turned, ponderously slow, but then lashed out swiftly and swept a massive paw at the dogs. The dogs scattered, and a number of young men seized the opportunity to drive them further away with stones and sticks. The bear swayed from side to side, scanning the crowd with those large, dolorous eyes. With a clear view of the animal, I noticed that it wore a leather collar studded with short spikes. Two chains were fastened to the collar, and they trailed away into the hands of two men. I hadn't seen them until then. They were bear handlers, dressed in vests, turbans, and trousers, all of which were a startling electric blue colour. Even their chests and faces were painted blue, as were the metal chains and collar of the bear. The bear turned and stood to face me again. Impossibly, one of the men who held its chains spoke my name.
"Mr. Lin. You are Mr. Lin, I am thinking so," he asked.
The bear tilted its head as if it too was asking the question.
"Yes," a few voices in the crowd called out. "Yes, this is Mr. Lin. This is Lin Baba."
I was still standing in the doorway of my hut, too surprised to speak or move. People were laughing and cheering. A few of the more courageous children crept almost close enough to touch the bear with darting fingers. Their mothers shrieked and laughed and gathered them back into their arms.
"We are your friends,"
one of the blue-faced men said in Hindi. His teeth were dazzling white against the blue.
"We have come with a message for you."
The second man took a crumpled yellow envelope from the pocket of his vest and held it up for me to see.
"A message?" I managed to ask.
"Yes, an important message for you, sir," the first man said. "But first, you must do something. There is a promise for giving the message. A big promise. You will like it very much."
They were speaking in Hindi, and I was unfamiliar with the word vachan, meaning promise. I stepped from the hut, edging around the bear. There were more people than I'd imagined, and they crowded together, just out of range of the bear's paws. Several people were repeating the Hindi word, vachan. A babble of other voices in several languages added to the shouts and stone-throwing and barking dogs to produce the sound effects of a minor riot. The dust on the stony paths rose up in puffs and swirls, and although we were in the centre of a modern city, that place of bamboo huts and gaping crowds might have been a village in a forgotten valley. The bear handlers, when I saw them clearly, seemed fantastic beings. Their bare arms and chests were well muscled beneath the blue paint, and their trousers were decorated with silver bells and discs and tassels of red and yellow silk. Both men had long hair, worn in dreadlocks as thick as two fingers, and tipped with coils of silver wire. I felt a hand on my arm and almost jumped. It was Prabhakar. His usual smile was preternaturally wide, and his dark eyes were happy.
"We are so lucky to have you live with us, Lin. You are always bringing it so many adventures of a fully not boring kind."
"I didn't bring this, Prabhu. What the hell are they saying? What do they want?"
"They have it a message for you, Lin. But there is a vachan, a promise, before they will give it the message. There is a, you know, a catches."
"A catches? Yes, sure. This is English word, yes?
Catches. It means like a little revenge for being nice."
Prabhakar grinned happily, seizing the opportunity to share one of his English definitions with me. It was his habit, or fortuity, always to find the most irritating moments to offer them.
"Yes, I know what a catch is, Prabhu. What I don't know is, who are these guys? Who's this message from?"
Prabhakar rattled away in rapid Hindi, delighted to be the focus of attention in the exchange. The bear handlers answered him in some detail, speaking just as swiftly. I couldn't understand much of what was said, but those in the crowd who were close enough to hear broke out in an explosion of laughter. The bear dropped down on all fours and sniffed at my feet.
"What did they say?"
"Lin,
They won't tell who is sending it the messages,
Prabhaka said, suppressing his own laughter with some difficulty.
This is a big secret, and they are not telling it. They have some instructions to give this message to you with nothing explanations, and with the one catches for you, like a promise.
What catch?
Well, you have to hug it, the bear.
I have to what?
Hug it, the bear. You have to give him a big cuddles, like this.
He reached out and grabbed me in a tight hug, his head pressed against my chest. The crowd applauded wildly. The bear handlers shrieked in a high-pitched keening, and even the bear was moved to stand and dance a thudding, stomp-footed jig. The bewilderment and obvious reluctance on my face drove the people to more and bigger laughter. No way, I said, shaking my head.
Oh, yes, Prabhaka laughed.
Are you kidding? No way, man.
Taklif nahi,
one of the bear handlers called out. No problem.
It is safe. Kano is very friendly. Kano is the friendliest bear in all India. Kano loves the people.
He moved closer to the bear, shouting commands in Hindi. When Kano the bear stood to his full height, the handler stepped in and embraced him. The bear closed its paws around him and rocked backwards and forwards. After a few seconds, it released the man, and he turned to the tumultuous applause of the crowd with a beaming smile and a showman's bow. No way, I said again.
Oh, come on, Lin, hug it the bear, Prabhaka pleaded, laughing harder.
I'm not hugging any bear, Prabhu.
Oh, come on, Lin, don't you want to know what is it, the messages?
No.
It might be important.
I don't care.
You might like that hugging bear, Lin, isn't it?
No.
You might.
I won't.
Well, maybe would you like me to give you another big hug for practice?
No, thanks all the same.
Then just hug it the bear, Lin.
Sorry.
Oh, please,
Prabhaka wheedled. No.
Yes, Lin, please hug it the bear,
Prabhaka encouraged, asking for support from the crowd. There were hundreds of people crammed into the lanes near my house. Children had found precarious vantage points on top of some of the sturdier huts.
Do it, do it, do it,
they wailed and shouted. Looking around me from face to laughing face, I realized that I didn't have any choice. I took the two steps, reached out tremulously, and slowly pressed myself against the shaggy fur of Kano the bear. He was surprisingly soft under the fur, almost pudgy. The thick forelegs were all muscle, however, and they closed around me at shoulder height with a massive power, a non-human strength. I knew what it was to feel utterly helpless. One fright-driven thought spun through my mind. Kano could snap my back as easily as I could snap a pencil. The bear's voice grumbled in his chest against my ear. A smell like wet moss filled my nostrils. Mixed with it was a smell like new leather shoes and the smell of a child's woolen blanket. Beyond that, there was a piercing ammoniac smell, like bone being cut with a saw. The noise of the crowd faded. Kano was warm. Kano moved from side to side. The fur in the grasp of my fingers was soft and attached to rolls of skin like that on the back of a dog's neck. I clung to the fur and rocked with him. In its brawny grip, it seemed to me that I was floating, or perhaps falling, from some exalted place of inexpressible peace and promise. Hands shook my shoulders, and I opened my eyes to see that I'd fallen to my knees. Kano the bear had released me from the hug, and was already at the end of the short lane, lumbering away with his slow, thumping tread in the company of his handlers and the retinue of people and maddened dogs.
Lin Baba, are you all right?
I'm fine. Fine. Must have... I got dizzy or something.
Kano was giving you the pretty good squeezes, yes? Here, this is your message.
I went back to my hut and sat at the small table made from packing crates. Inside the crumpled envelope was a typed note on matching yellow paper. It was typed in English, and I suspected that it had been typed by one of the professional letter writers on the Street of the Writers. It was from Abdullah.
My dear brother, Salam Alaikum. You told me that you are giving the bear hugs to the people. I think this is a custom in your country. And even if I think it is very strange, and even if I do not understand, I think you must be lonely for it here, because in Bombay we have a shortage of bears. So I send you a bear for some hugging. Please enjoy. I hope he's like the hugging bears in your country. I am busy with business, and I am healthy, thanks be to God. After my business, I will return to Bombay soon, inshallah. God bless you and your brother. Abdullah Tahiri.
Prabhakar was standing at my left shoulder, reading the note out loud, slowly.
Ah, this is the Abdullah who I'm not supposed to be telling you that he is doing all the bad things, but really he is, even at the same time that I'm not telling you that he is.
It's rude to read other people's mail, Prabhu.
It's rude, yes. Rude means that we like to do it, even when people tell us not to, yes?
Who are those bear guys? I asked him. Where are they staying?
They are making money with the dancing bear. They are original from UP, Uttar Pradesh, in the north of this our mother India, but travelling everywhere. Now they are staying at the Jopadpati in Navi Naga area. Do you want me to take you there?
No, I muttered, reading the note over again. No, not now. Maybe later. Prabhakar went to the open door of the hut and paused there, staring at me reflectively, with his small round head cocked to one side. I put the note in my pocket and looked at him. I thought he wanted to say something. There was a little struggle of concentration in his brow. But then he seemed to change his mind. He shrugged. He smiled.
Some Sikh people are coming today?
A few, I think. Later.
Well, I will be seeing you at the lunch party, yes?
Sure.
Do you want me for to do anything?
No, thanks.
Do you want my neighbor, his wife, to wash it, your shirt?
Wash my shirt?
Yes, it is smelling like bears. You are smelling like bears, Lin Baba.
It's okay, I laughed. I kind of like it.
Well, I'm going now. I'm going to drive my cousin Shantu's taxi.
Okay, then.
All right. I'm going now.
He walked out, and when I was alone again, the sounds of the slum swarmed around me. Hawkers selling, children playing, women laughing, and love songs blaring from radios running on maximum distortion. There were also animal sounds, hundreds of them. With only days to go before the big rain, many itinerants and entertainers, like the two bear handlers, had sought shelter in slums throughout the city. Ours was host to three groups of snake charmers, a team of monkey men, and numerous breeders of parrots and singing birds. The men who usually tethered horses in open ground near the Navy barracks brought their mounts to our makeshift stables. Goats and sheep and pigs, chickens and bullocks and water buffalo, even a camel and an elephant. The acres of the slum had become a kind of sprawling ark, providing sanctuary from the coming floods. The animals were welcome, and no one questioned their right to shelter. But their presence did pose new problems. On the first night of their stay, the monkey men allowed one of their animals to escape while everyone was asleep. The mischievous creature scampered over the tops of several huts and lowered itself into the hut used by one group of snake charmers. The snake men housed their cobras in covered wicker baskets, which were secured with a bamboo slip catch and a stone placed on top of each cover. The monkey removed one of the stones and opened a basket containing three cobras. From a safe vantage point at the top of the hut, the monkey shrieked the snake men awake and they sounded the alarm.
Sabala! Sap, Allah! Sap!
Snakes are coming. Snakes. There was pandemonium then, as sleepy slum dwellers rushed about with kerosene lanterns and flaming torches, striking at every shadow, and beating each other on the feet and shins with sticks and poles. A few of the flimsier huts were knocked over in the stampede. Kasim Ali finally restored order and organized the snake men into two search parties that combed the slums systematically until they found the cobras and returned them to their basket. Among their many other skills, the monkeys had also been trained to be excellent thieves. Like most of the slums throughout the city, ours was a stealing-free zone. With no locks on any of the doors, and no secret places for any of us to hide things, the monkeys were in a pilferer's paradise. Each day, the embarrassed monkey men were forced to set up a table outside their hut, where all the items their monkeys had stolen could be displayed and reclaimed by the rightful owners. The monkeys showed a marked preference for the glass bangles and brass anklets or bracelets worn by most of the little girls. Even after the monkey men bought them their own supply of the baubles and festooned their hairy arms and legs with them, the monkeys still found the theft of such jewellery irresistible. Kasim Ali decided at last to have noisy bells put on all the monkeys while they were within the slum. The creatures displayed an inventive resourcefulness in divesting themselves of the bells or in smothering them. I once saw two monkeys stalking along the deserted lane outside my hut at dusk, their eyes huge with simian guilt and mischief. One of them had succeeded in removing the bells from around its neck. It walked on its hind legs in tandem with the other ape, muffling the noise of the other's bells by holding onto them with both tiny hands. Despite their ingenuity, the bell music did make their usually noiseless capering more detectable, reducing their small felonies and the shame of their handlers. Along with those itinerants, many of the people who lived on the streets near our slum were drawn to the relative security of our huts. Known as pavement dwellers, they were people who made homes for themselves on every available strip of unused land and any footpath wide enough to support their flimsy shelters, while still permitting pedestrian traffic. Their houses were the most primitive, and the conditions under which they lived the most harsh and brutalizing of all the millions of homeless people in Bombay. When the monsoon struck, their position was always dangerous and sometimes untenable, and many of them sought refuge in the slums. They were from every part of India. Assamese and Tamils, Karnatakans and Gujaratis, people from Trivandrum, Bikaner and Konarak. During the monsoon, 5,000 of those extra souls squeezed themselves into the already overcrowded slum. With subtractions for the space taken up by animal pens, shops, storage areas, streets, lanes and latrines, that allowed some 2 square meters for each man, woman and child among us. The greater than usual crowding caused some tensions and additional difficulties, but in the main, the newcomers were treated tolerantly. I never heard anyone suggest that they shouldn't have been helped or made welcome. The only serious problems, in fact, came from outside the slum. Those 5,000 extra people, and the many thousands who'd flocked to other slums as the monsoon approached, had been living on the streets. They'd all done their shopping, such as it was, in shops throughout the area. Their purchases were individually small. Eggs, milk, tea, bread, cigarettes, vegetables, kerosene, children's clothes, and so on. Collectively, they accounted for large amounts of money and a considerable portion of the trade for local shops. When they moved to the slums, however, the newcomers tended to spend their money at the dozens of tiny shops within the slums. The small, illegal businesses supplied almost everything that could be bought in the legal shops of the well-established shopping districts. There were shops that supplied food, clothing, oils, pulses, kerosene, alcohol, hashish, and even electrical appliances. The slum was largely self-contained, and Johnny Cigar, a money and tax advisor to the slum businesses, estimated that the slum dwellers spent 20 rupees within the slum for every 1 rupee they spent outside it. Shopkeepers and small businessmen everywhere resented that attrition of their sales and the success of the thriving slum shops. When the threat of rain pulled even the pavement dwellers into the slums, their resentment turned to rage. They joined forces with local landlords, property developers, and others who feared and opposed the expansion of the slums. Pooling their resources, they recruited 2 gangs of thugs from areas outside Colaba and paid them to attack the supply lines to slum shops. Those returning from the large markets with cartloads of vegetables or fish or dry goods for shops in the slum were harassed, had their goods spoiled, and were sometimes even assaulted. I treated several children and young men who'd been attacked by those gangs. There had been threats that acid would be thrown. Unable to appeal to the police for help, the cops had been paid to maintain a discreet myopia. The slum dwellers banded together to defend themselves. Kasim Ali formed brigades of children who patrolled the perimeter of the slum as lookouts, and several platoons of strong young men to escort those who visited the markets. Clashes had already occurred between our young men and the hired thugs. We all knew that when the monsoon came, there would be more and greater violence. Tensions ran high. Still, the war of the shopkeepers didn't dispirit the slum dwellers. On the contrary, the shopkeepers within the slum experienced a surge of popularity. They became demi-heroes and were moved to respond with special sales, reduced prices, and a carnival atmosphere. The ghetto was a living organism. To counter external threats, it responded with the antibodies of courage, solidarity, and that desperate, magnificent love we usually call the survival instinct. If the slum failed, there was nowhere and nothing else. One of the young men who'd been injured in an attack on our supply lines was a labourer on the construction site beside the slum. His name was Naresh. He was 19 years old. It was his voice and a confident rapping on the open door of my hut, which scattered the brief, still solitude that I'd found when my friends and neighbours had followed Kano and his bear handlers from the slum. Without waiting for me to reply, Naresh stepped into the hut and greeted me.
"Hello, Lin Baba," he greeted me in English. "You have been hugging at bears, everyone says."
"Hello, Naresh. How's your arm? You want me to take a look at it?"
"If you have time, yes," he answered,
switching to Marathi, his native tongue.
"I took a break from work, and I have to return in 15 or 20 minutes. I can come back another time if you are busy."
"No, now's okay. Come and sit down, and we'll have a look." Naresh had been slashed on the upper arm with a barber's straight razor. The cut wasn't deep, and it should have healed quickly with no more than a wrap of bandage. The unclean humidity of his working conditions, however, accelerated the risk of infection. The bandage I'd placed on his arm just 2 days before was filthy and soaked with sweat. I removed it and stored the soiled dressing in a plastic bag for disposal later in one of the communal fires. The wound was beginning to knit well enough, but it was an angry red, with some flares of yellowish-white. Kadabai's lepers had supplied me with a 10-litre container of surgical disinfectant. I used it to wash my hands and then cleansed the wound, roughly scraping at it until there was no trace of the white infection. It must have been tender, but Naresh endured the pain expressionlessly. When it was dry, I squeezed antibiotic powder into the crease of the cut and applied a fresh gauze dressing and bandage.
"Prabhakar tells me you had a narrow escape from the police the other night, Naresh," I said as I worked, stumbling along in my broken Marathi.
"Prabhakar has a disappointing habit of telling everybody the truth," Naresh frowned.
"You're telling me," I answered quickly, and we both laughed. Like most of the Maharashtrians, Naresh was happy that I tried to learn his language. And like most of them, he spoke slowly and very precisely, encouraging me to understand. There were no parallels between Marathi and English, it seemed to me. None of the similarities and familiar words that were shared by English and German, for example, or English and Italian. Yet Marathi was an easy language to learn, because the people of Maharashtra were thrilled that I wanted to learn it, and they were very eager to teach.
"If you keep stealing with Asif and his gang," I said more seriously, "you're going to get caught."
"I know that, but I hope not. I hope the Enlightened One is on my side. It's for my sister. I pray that no harm will come to me, you see, because I am not stealing for myself, but for my sister. She will be married soon, and there is not enough to pay the promised dowry. It is my responsibility. I am the oldest son.
Naresh was brave, intelligent, hard-working, and kind with the young children. His hut wasn't much bigger than my own, but he shared it with his parents and 6 brothers and sisters. He slept outside on the rough ground to leave more space for the younger ones inside. I'd visited his hut several times, and I knew that everything he owned in the world was contained in 1 plastic shopping bag. A change of rough clothes, 1 pair of good trousers and a shirt for formal occasions and for visiting the temple, a book of Buddhist verses, several photographs, and a few toiletries. He owned nothing else. He gave every rupee that he earned from his job or made from petty thefts to his mother, asking her for small change in return as he required it. He didn't drink or smoke or gamble. As a poor man with no immediate prospects, he had no girlfriend and only a slender chance of winning one. The one entertainment he allowed himself was a trip to the cheapest cinema with his workmates once a week. Yet he was a cheerful, optimistic young man. Sometimes, when I came home through the slum late at night, I saw him curled up on the path outside the family hut, his thin young face slackened in sleep's exhausted smile. "And you, Naresh?" I asked, fastening the bandage with a safety pin. "When will you get married?" He stood, flexing his slender arm to loosen the tight bandage.
"After Poonam is married, there are 2 other sisters who must be married," he explained, smiling and wagging his head from side to side. "They must be first. In this, or Bombay, the poor man must look for husbands before he looks for a wife. Crazy, isn't it? Amchi Mumbai, Mumbai Amchi."
"It's our Bombay, and Bombay is ours." He went out without thanking me, as was usual with the people I treated at my hut. I knew that he would invite me to dinner at his house one day soon, or bring me a gift of fruit or special incense. The people showed thanks rather than saying it, and I'd come to accept that. When Naresh emerged from my hut with a clean bandage, several people who saw him approached me for treatment. I attended to them one by one, rat bites, fever, infected rashes, ringworm, chatting with each and catching up on the gossip that constantly swirled through the lanes and gullies like the ubiquitous dust devils. The last of those patients was an elderly woman accompanied by her niece. She complained of pains in her chest on the left side, but the extremes of Indian modesty made examination a complex procedure. I asked the girl to summon others to help. 2 of the niece's young friends joined her in my hut. The friends held a sheet of thick cloth up between the elderly woman and myself, completely obscuring her from my view. The girl was standing beside her aunt in a position where she could look over the blanket and see me sitting on the other side. Then, as I touched my own chest here and there, the young niece imitated me by touching her aunt's breast. "Does it hurt here?" I asked, probing my own chest above the nipple. Behind the screen, the niece probed at her aunt's breast, asking my question.
"No."
"How about here?"
"No, not there."
"What about here?"
"Yes, there it is hurting," she answered.
"And here? Or here?"
"No, not there. A little bit here."
With that pantomime, and through the invisible hands of her niece, I finally established that the elderly woman had 2 painful lumps in her breast. I also learnt that she experienced some pain with deep breaths and when lifting heavy objects. I wrote a note for Dr. Hamid, detailing my second-hand observations and my conclusions. I'd just finished explaining to the girl that she should take her aunt to Dr. Hamid's surgery at once and give him my note, when a voice spoke behind me.
"You know, poverty looks good on you. If you ever got really down and out, you might be irresistible."
I turned in surprise to see Kala leaning in the doorway with her arms folded. An ironic half-smile turned up the corners of her mouth. She was dressed in green, loose silk trousers and a long-sleeved top, with a shawl of darker green. Her black hair was free and burnished with copper tints by the sun. The green of warm, shallow water in a dreamed lagoon blazed in her eyes. She was almost too beautiful as a blush of summer sunset on a sky-wide stream of cloud. "How long have you been there?" I asked, laughing.
"Long enough to see this weird faith-healing system of yours in operation. Are you curing people by telepathy now?"
"Indian women are very obstinate when it comes to having their breasts handled by strangers," I replied, when the patient and her relatives had filed past Carla and left the hut.
"Nobody's perfect, as Didier would say,"
she drawled with a smirk that fluttered just short of a smile.
"He misses you, by the way. He asked me to say hello to you. In fact, they all miss you. We haven't seen much of you at Leopold's since you started this Red Cross routine."
I was glad that Didier and the others hadn't forgotten me, but I didn't look her in the eye. When I was alone, I felt safe and satisfyingly busy in the slum. Whenever I saw friends from beyond those sprawling acres, a part of me shriveled in shame. "Fear and guilt are the dark angels that haunt rich men," Kader said to me once. I wasn't sure if that was true, or if he simply wanted it to be true. But I did know from experience that despair and humiliation haunt the poor. "Come in, come in. This is a real surprise. Sit here while I just clean up a bit." She came over and sat on the wooden stool as I gathered a plastic bag containing used swabs and bandages and swept the last of the litter into it. I washed my hands with spirit once more and packed the medicines into the little rack of shelves. She looked around the small hut, examining everything with a critical eye. As my gaze followed hers, I saw my little house for the shabby, threadbare hovel that it really was. Because I lived alone in the hut, I'd come to think of it as luxuriously spacious, in contrast to the crowding that was everywhere around me. With her beside me, it seemed mean and cramped. The bare earth floor was cracked and formed in lumpy undulations. Holes as big as my fist punctured every wall, exposing my life to the brawl and business of the bustling lane outside. Children peeped in through the holes at Carla and me, emphasizing how unprivate my life there was. The reed matting of the roof sagged and had even given way in a few places. My kitchen consisted of a single burner kerosene stove, two cups, two metal plates, a knife, a fork, a spoon, and a few containers of spices. The whole of it fitted into a cardboard box and was stored in one corner. I was in the habit of buying only enough for a single meal at a time, so there was no food. The water was stored in an earthenware mutka. It was slum water. I couldn't offer it to her because I knew Carla couldn't drink it. My only furniture was a cupboard for medicines, a small table, a chair, and a wooden stool. I remembered how delighted I'd been when those sticks of furniture were given to me, how rare they were in the slum. With her eyes, I saw the cracks in the wood, the stains of mildew, the repairs made with wire and string. I looked back to where she sat on the stool, lighting a cigarette and blowing the smoke out through the side of her mouth. A rush of irrational resentment seized me. I was almost angry that she'd made me see the unlovely truth of my house. It's not much,
It's fine, she said, reading my heart. I lived in a little hut like this in Goa for a year once, and I was happy. There isn't a day goes by when I don't feel like going back there. I sometimes think that the size of our happiness is inversely proportional to the size of our house.
She raised her left eyebrow in a high arch as she said it, challenging me to respond and meet her on her level. And with that gesture, it was all right between us. I wasn't resentful anymore. I knew, I was certain somehow, that wanting my little house to be bigger or brighter or grander than it was had been in my mind, not hers. She wasn't judging. She was only looking, seeing everything. Even what I felt. My neighbour's 12-year-old son, Satish, came into the hut, carrying his tiny 2-year-old cousin on his hip. He stood close to Carla, staring unselfconsciously. She stared back at him just as intently, and I was struck by how similar they were in that instant, the Indian boy and the European woman. Both had full-lipped, expressive mouths and hair that was night sky black. And although Carla's eyes were sea green and the boy's were dark bronze, each pair wore the same grave expression, full of interest and humour. Satish, chai bono, I said to him. Make some tea. He gave me a quick smile and hurried out. Carla was the first foreign miss he'd ever seen in the slum, so far as I knew. He was excited to have the task of serving her. I knew he would talk about it to the other kids for weeks afterwards. So, tell me, how did you find me? How did you even get in here? I asked her when we were alone.
Get in, she frowned. It's not illegal to visit you, is it?
No, I laughed, but it's not common either. I don't get many visitors here.
Actually, it was easy. I just stepped off the street and asked people to take me to you.
And they brought you here?
Not exactly. They're very protective of you, you know. They took me to your friend, Prabhakar, first. And he brought me to you.
Prabhakar. Yes, Lynn, you want me? Prabhakar said, popping through the doorway from his eavesdropping post outside. I thought you were going to drive your taxi, I muttered, adopting the stern expression that I knew amused him the most.
My cousin Shantu's taxi, he said, grinning. Was driving, yes, but now my other cousin, Prakash, he is driving, while I am taking it my 2 hours of lunch breaks. I was at Johnny Cigar, his house, when some people came here with Miss Carla. She wants to see you, and I came here. It is very good, yes?
It's good, Prabhu, I sighed. Satish returned, carrying a tray with 3 cups of hot sweet tea. He handed them to us and tore open a small packet containing 4 Parle Gluco biscuits, which he presented to us with a solemn sense of ceremony. I expected him to eat the 4th biscuit himself, but he placed it on his palm instead, marked it off into even sections with his grubby thumbnail, and then broke it into 2 pieces. Measuring the fragments against one another, he picked the one that was minutely larger and handed it to Carla. The other went to his baby cousin, who sat in the doorway of the hut and nibbled at the biscuit happily. I was sitting on the straight-backed chair, and Satish came over to squat on the floor beside my feet. He rested his shoulder against my knee. I was big enough to know that the rare show of affection was a breakthrough with Satish. At the same time, I was small enough to hope that Carla had noticed it and was impressed by it. We finished the tea, and Satish gathered the empty cups, leaving the hut without a word. At the door, he gave Carla a long-lashed, lingering smile as he took his cousin's hand to lead her away.
He's a nice kid, she remarked.
He is. My next-door neighbor's son. You really sparked something in him today. He's normally very shy. So what brings you to my humble home anyway?
Oh, I just happened to be in the area, she said nonchalantly,
looking at the gaps in my wall where a dozen little faces stared in at us. The voices of other children could be heard questioning Satish about her. Who is she? Is she Lynn Baba's wife? Passing by, huh? It couldn't be maybe that you missed me just a little bit?
Hey, don't push your luck, she mocked.
I can't help it. It's a genetic thing. I come from a long line of luck pushers. Don't take it personally.
I take everything personally. That's what being a person is all about. And I'll take you to lunch if you finish with your patience.
Well, I have a lunch date, actually.
Oh, okay then.
No, you're welcome to come if you like. It's kind of an open invitation. We're having a celebration lunch today, right here. I'd be very happy if you'd be our guest. I think you'll like it. Tell us you'll like it, Prabhu.
We will have it a very nice lunches, Prabhaka said. My good self, I have kept it a complete empty stomach for filling up to fat. So good is the food. You will enjoy so much that people will think you are having a baby inside your dress.
Okay, she said slowly, then looked at me. He's a persuasive guy, your Prabhakar.
He should meet his father, I replied, shaking my head in a resigned shrug. Prabhakar's chest swelled with pride, and he wagged his head happily.
So, where are we going?
It's at the village in the sky, I told her.
I don't think I've heard of it, she said, frowning.
Prabhakar and I laughed, and the vaguely suspicious furrows in her brow deepened. No, you won't have heard of it, but I think you'll like it. Listen, you go on ahead with Prabhakar. I'll wash up and change my shirt. I'll just be a couple of minutes, okay?
Fine, she said.
Our eyes met and held. For some reason, she lingered, watching me expectantly. I couldn't understand the expression, and I was still trying to read it when she stepped close to me and quickly kissed my lips. It was a friendly kiss, impulsive and generous and light-hearted. But I let myself believe that it was more. She walked out with Prabhakar, and I spun around on one foot, whispering a shout of joy while I did an excited little dance. I looked up to see the children peering through the holes in the hut and giggling at me. I made a scary face at them, and they laughed harder, breaking into little whirling parodies of my dance. 2 minutes later, I loped through the slum lanes after Prabhakar and Kala, tucking my clean shirt into my pants as I ran, and shaking the water from my hair. Our slum, like many others in Bombay, came into being to serve the needs of a construction site. 2 35-floor buildings, the World Trade Center towers, being built on the shore of the Kalaba Back Bay. The tradesmen, artisans, and labourers who built the towers were housed in hutments, tiny slum dwellings, on land adjacent to the site. The companies that planned and constructed large buildings in those years were forced to provide such land for housing. Many of the tradesmen were itinerant workers who followed where their skills were needed and whose real homes were hundreds of kilometres away in other states. Most of the workers who were native to Bombay simply had no homes, other than those they found with their jobs. In fact, many men accepted the risks of that hard and dangerous work for no other reason than to gain the security of one of those shelters. The companies were happy enough to comply with the laws that made land and huts available, because the arrangement was eminently suitable to them in other ways. The kinship fostered in workers' slums guaranteed a sense of unity, familial solidarity, and loyalty to the company, which served employers well. Travelling time to and from work was eliminated when men lived on the site. The wives, children, and other dependents of employed workers provided a ready source of additional labourers. They were hired from that pool and put to work, from day to day, at a moment's notice. And the entire workforce of several thousand people were much more easily influenced, and to some extent even controlled, when they lived in a single community. When the World Trade Center towers were first planned, a large area was set aside and marked off into more than 300 hut-sized plots. As workers signed on, they received one of the plots and a sum of money with which to buy bamboo poles, reed matting, hemp rope, and scrap timber. Each man then built his own house, assisted by family and friends. The sprawl of fragile huts spread outward like a shallow, tender root system for the huge towers that were to come. Vast underground wells were sunk to provide water for the community. Rudimentary lanes and pathways were scraped flat. Finally, a tall barbed wire fence was erected around the perimeter to keep out squatters. The legal slum was born. Drawn by the regular wages that those workers had to spend, and no less by the plentiful supply of fresh water, squatters soon arrived and settled outside the fence line. Entrepreneurs establishing chai shops and small grocery stores were the first, attaching their tiny shops to the fence. Workers from the legal compound stooped to crouch through gaps in the wire
and spend their money. Vegetable shops and tailor shops and little restaurants were next. Gambling dens and other dens for the sale of alcohol or charis soon followed. Each new business clung to the fence of the compound, until at last there was no space left on the fence line. The illegal slum then began to grow outward into the surrounding acres of open land leading to the sea. Homeless people joined in ever larger numbers, picking out squares for their huts. New holes were stretched in the fence. Squatters used them to enter the legal slum to collect water, and workers used them to make purchases in the illegal slum, or visit new friends. The squatters' slum grew rapidly, but with a haphazard, needs-driven planlessness that was a disorderly contrast to the neater lanes of the workers' slum. In time, there were 8 squatters for every person in the workers' compound, more than 25,000 people in all, and the division between legal and illegal slums became blurred, camouflaged by the crowding. Although the Bombay Municipal Corporation condemned the illegal slum, and construction company officers discouraged contact between workers and squatters, the people thought of themselves as one group. Their days and dreams and drives were entangled in the ravel of ghetto life. To workers and squatters alike, the company fence was like all fences, arbitrary and irrelevant. Some of the workers who weren't permitted to bring more than immediate family into the legal slum invited their relatives to squat near them beyond the wire. Friendships flourished among the children of both sides, and marriages of love or arrangement were common. Celebrations on one side of the wire were well attended by residents from both sides, and because fires, floods, and epidemics didn't recognize barbed wire boundaries, emergencies in one part of the slum required the close cooperation of all. Carla, Prabhakar and I bent low to step through an opening in a section of fence, and we passed into the legal slum. A covey of children trooped along beside us, dressed in freshly washed T-shirts and dresses. They all knew Prabhakar and me well. I'd treated many of the young children, cleansing and bandaging cuts, abrasions and rat bites. And more than a few of the workers, afraid that they might be stood down from work when they received minor injuries on the construction site, had visited my free clinic rather than the company's first aid officer.
"You know everybody here," Carla remarked as we were stopped for the fifth time by a group of neighbours. "Are you running for mayor of this place or what?"
"Hell no, I can't stand politicians. A politician is someone who promises you a bridge even when there's no river."
"That's not bad," she murmured.
Her eyes were laughing. "I wish I could say it was mine," I grinned. "An actor named Amitabh said it."
"Amitabh Bachchan?" she asked. "The big B himself."
"Yeah. Do you like Bollywood movies?"
"Sure. Why not?"
"I don't know," I answered, shaking my head. "I just didn't think you would." There was a pause then that became an awkward silence. She was the first to speak.
"But you do know a lot of people here, and they like you a lot."
I frowned, genuinely surprised by the suggestion. It never occurred to me that the people in the slum might like me. I knew that some men, Prabhakar, Johnny Sagar, even Kasim Ali Hussein, regarded me as a friend. I knew that some others treated me with a respect that seemed honest and unfeigned. But I didn't consider the friendship or the respect as any part of being liked. "This is a special day," I said, smiling and trying to shift ground. "The people have been trying for years to get their own primary school. They've got about 800 school-age kids, but the schools for miles around are full and can't take them. The people got their own teachers organised and found a good spot for a school, but the authorities still put up a hell of a fight."
"Because it's a slum."
"Yeah. They're afraid that a school would give the place a kind of legitimacy. In theory, the slum doesn't exist because it's not legal and not recognised."
"We are the not people," Prabhakar said happily. "And these are the not houses where we are not living."
"And now we have a not school to go with it," I concluded for him. the municipality finally agreed to a kind of compromise. They allowed them to set up a temporary school near here, and there'll be another one organized soon. But they'll have to tear them down when the